Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This real-life tragedy began on a stormy night with a knock at the front door. A friend needed help with his car. What happened to Carl, Lisa, Gregory, and Felicia that night is worse than any fictional horror story you've ever read or seen on the big screen. Little girls should never have to live in a barrel. Award-winning journalist and best-selling author George Gerrard takes readers on a gripping and chilling journey with his latest true crime book, The Creekside Bones, Realities More Horrifying Than Fiction. The book details how the Elliott family in Dalton, Arkansas, lived in constant fear in the summer 1998. How they met their fates is ghastly. Gerrard covered two murder trials in connection with the case and provides his own theories as to how and why the Elliott family was murdered. Four other murder cases are also detailed in the book. Sidney Nicole Randall was a beauty pageant queen, about to enter high school when a monster stole her away in the dark. Bridget Sellers was a mother of three who vanished without a trace while on a walk down Peace Valley Road. Her fate is incomprehensible. Bob Castleman was a respected attorney and Vietnam War vet until the drugs, murder, a live copperhead snake, Native American artifact fraud consumed his life. The book also includes an update on the unsolved Rebecca Gould case. 22-year-old college student was murdered September 20, 2004, in Melbourne, Arkansas. There are suspects in the case, but to this day, no one has been jailed for her brutal death. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Creekside Bones, Reality is More Horrifying Than Fiction, with my special guest journalist and author, George Gerrard. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, George Gerrard.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, another series of cases I had no idea about, and much worse than fiction, more horrifying. Let's jump right into this. This especially, you start off with this incredible story, as we mentioned, of the Elliots, Lisa and Carl. Carl Elliott's 30 years old, and you talk about the two kids. Felicia is 8 and Gregory is 7 years old. And the father and stepmom live very close, and this is in Dalton, Arkansas. And you talk about Hardy, Arkansas, too. So set the stage for, you talk about them living very close to her parents in a trailer. So set that stage. What were the living accommodations? And tell us a little bit about Lisa and Carl, what was going on at that time, and what, as you describe the area and what it's known for. Tell us a little bit about this. Set the stage. July 29th, 1998.
Dalton is a small town in northern Arkansas. It's a kind of a unique and interesting place. It's the only county in the United States where five navigable rivers are located. It's very rural. It's actually a really beautiful place, a lot of rolling hills, cattle farms. And in fact, the two oldest structures still on their original foundation west of the Mississippi River are in Dalton, the Rice Upshaw House and the Looney Tavern. They spend millions of dollars restoring these two structures. So it's a very historic and beautiful place. But there's also another part of it. You know, it is, there's a sparse population there. And it's just the kind of place that's really convenient if you're in the drug trade. It's a good place to live. It's hard for law enforcement to get in there. Everybody knows everybody out in a place like Dalton. Carl and Lisa, they lived in a house. It was a family house. And Lisa's dad and stepmother lived in a trailer adjacent to their house. And the father, I believe, he had some I think he had some hearing problems and he had some mental issues, as did the stepmother. So they were not, when this whole thing went down, they really weren't like reliable witnesses, I guess is the best way to put it. You know, they were elderly and incapable of giving the police any really good information. Carl was a carpenter and a mechanic. Like you said before, they had two kids. They had Felicia, who was 8, and Gregory, who was 6. What happened in the summer of 1998 is they were Carl was involved in some like minor drug stuff with the Green family. The Greens were a really just a violent group of people who lived up in Randolph County. Their patriarch, Billy Green, he was a big-time drug trafficker. Just the drug stuff alone would have kept him in prison for the rest of his life once he was finally charged and convicted on those in those cases. Billy had a son, his oldest son, Chad, and they were just about inseparable. He was really brutal to his son, but they were in the drug trade together, and Carl was friends with Chad. And something happened in the summer of 1998 with the dynamic between the Greens and Carl. There were rumors that he stole a number of marijuana plants from them. There are other rumors that he took cash. A couple weeks before the murders, Lisa was she asked the guy if he would loan them $10,000 to pay off a debt. So there was all this stuff was swirling. Other family members who came to visit the Elliots said they would sleep at night with baseball bats in their beds for fear that somebody would show up at their door. And this all culminated on July 29th, 1998. Carl's family, they were getting ready to go to bed, and there was a knock at the door. Chad Green, he had a truck, and it had broken down about a mile from their house along the 11 Point River. So Carl gets up, puts his shoes on, gets into his Thunderbird, and drives Chad back to his truck. Pouring down rain, and no one knows what happened at that sandbar. All they know is within a few minutes, Carl is shot twice and his body has been slung into the 11 Point River. The Thunderbird returns, the door opens, the little boy comes running up to the door, and I just, you know, from seeing the crime scene photos, that more than likely happened, the kid saw the Thunderbird pull up, thought it was his dad, so he just ran to the door to greet his dad. But when the door opened, the killer came inside, crushed the kid's head like an eggshell with a tire tool, and then jammed the pointed end of it through the kid's throat, and he bled out all over the floor. And then the mother came in to try to save her son, and the killer hit her 27 times with this tire tool. And there was blood everywhere. I talked to one detective about this case, and he said he was a veteran. He had covered many murder cases or investigated many murder cases. He said he had never seen a crime scene like this in his entire life. He said he had nightmares about it for years. And so once the killer is done with the mother, the killer goes into Felicia's room, and there's a picture of the tire tool dropped amongst all of her stuffed animals that were in a pot. She's hiding under her bed. Killer takes her, wraps her in a blanket, and puts her in the trunk of the Thunderbird. Well, as the killer or killers are getting ready to leave, they notice something in the yard, something moving. And what it was Lisa. She had woken up. They thought she was dead. She woke up. She climbed out the window of the kitchen, and she was crawling across the yard to get to her parents' house. And when she gets there, she literally gets to the door. Her hand is on the door. There's actually a bloody handprint that you can see. The killer or killers run up behind her, slash her throat all the way across, and she bleeds out on their porch. They didn't know she was there till the next morning, and because they couldn't open the door, and they didn't know what was jamming the door. And so the little girl's taken. There's a lot they don't know definitively what happened to her. There's lots of stories, but they do know that her bones were found in a creek a couple years later, about a half a mile from the Green clan's house, Billy Green's house. And it was out in the middle of nowhere, and that's why I titled the book The Creekside Bones, because that's where they found Felicia.
Let's go back just a little bit, because right away after this brutal murder and this crime scene that you say that even veterans still have nightmares about, the first logical suspect, because Carl and Felicia are missing. So let's go back to how everything is discovered, but also Carl is the suspect initially, isn't he? So tell us what happens next.
Yes, he was the suspect. You know, when they found Lisa and Gregory's bodies the next morning, you know, he was missing, Felicia was missing, so the first assumption was that he had killed his wife and son and taken his daughter. That theory ended on August 2nd, 1998, when they found his body in the river. And from that point on, they knew they were, the police knew that they were dealing with, they were going to have to find some unknown person or persons who committed this crime. And the Greens were identified as semi-suspects kind of early on, the first couple months of the investigation. They were interviewed a couple times, Chad was. And the problem was that there was very little forensic or DNA evidence at the crime scene. They just had nothing to go with. But as time went on, you know, like I said, in a little place like Dalton, everybody knows everybody, and stories start to get out. And so the police, within a year or two, were starting to hear some pretty strong machinations that the Greens were involved in the murders. And they knew that Carl and the Greens had been involved in some drug trafficking together. So they were, for several years, they would bring them in and interview them, but they never could pin anything to them. What changed, and ironically enough, it was 5 years to the day, it was July 29, 2003, Mary Green, Billy's former wife, she finally confessed the crime to the police. She told them exactly what happened, what she was told by her son and some things that Billy had said. And so, 5 years to the day, they arrest the two. Immediately they try to get Chad to turn on Billy. So they wanted to turn him into a witness. They gave him a sweetheart deal. They said, hey, if you will testify against your father, we'll give you 37 years in prison for all four capital murders. And he also had an unrelated sexual assault of a child crime that had been that he was having to deal with as well. So they just packaged it all together. And they said, 37 years, testify against your dad. He agreed to it. So then in 2004, Billy goes to trial. He's convicted. He's put on Arkansas's death row. And the case was basically, it was over. You know, everybody was happy. Let me back up a little bit. So during the trial, a woman got on the stand and said that she was scared of Billy. And that she thought that he might have had something to do with the murder of her nephew. Well, and you know this, Dan, you know, when you're testifying in a capital murder case or any case, you have to kind of stick – you have to stick to the facts of that case. You can't, you know, bring up things like that. So the judge should have declared a mistrial right there. He didn't. So on appeal, the conviction was thrown out. Now, prosecutors were in for a surprise because obviously they were going to immediately – retry him. Well, they got a surprise when Chad said, I'm not going to testify against my dad second time. And so they had a quandary, and it actually was about to go to the U.S. Supreme Court because his lawyers were claiming double jeopardy because prosecutors said, okay, fine, if you're not going to testify, you know what we're going to do, we're just going to recharge you with all four counts of capital murder and the sexual assault. And his lawyers argued that, no, you can't do that. It's that would violate his double jeopardy rights. So eventually it did work its way through the court system, and basically the finding was that if he didn't agree to the plea deal, then it didn't exist. So it right. couldn't violate his double jeopardy laws. So Chad was charged with four counts of capital murder, the sex assault charge. On the sex assault charge alone, he got, I think, 50 years. And then, of course, they go to trial I believe it was September 2011, and prosecutors were able to prove that Chad was a lot more culpable in the murders than what was initially thought. Initially, the police had had the theory that Billy was the mastermind and that Chad was just the unwilling dupe who went along with his dad and did what he was told. Well, right. There was always a problem with that for me. Studying the case for one simple reason. Billy was a very sophisticated criminal. He had like radios at his house. He was monitoring police traffic all the time. He had informants everywhere that he paid off to keep information for him and get information for him. And the one thing that surprised me about the whole incident was the little girl was taken. And Billy, for all of his horrible deeds in life, I never came across any time that he'd been charged with, like, pedophilia. And Chad, you know, that sex assault charge that he had previously was for molesting an 8-year-old girl. And so in my mind, I was sitting there going, okay, whoever did this, the motivation was the little girl because she was taken. And I'll never forget it, during Chad's trial. Number one, and another thing that would have probably caused this case to go back to court anyway, was prosecutors didn't divulge back in 2004 that Chad actually confessed to the murders. Said he did them all by himself and his dad wasn't even involved. And he did this with an attorney and a private investigator. He confessed this. Well, they never divulged that to Billy's defense team at that time. So right there, I mean, it was almost bad enough that the judge in the case had to even consider if Billy was going to go to trial a second time once this was found out in 2011. But then he finally decided to go ahead and let it move forward. So, in my mind, I just don't think if Billy had been there at the crime scene, I don't think he would have allowed Chad to take the girl because the girl would have led the police right to them. And back at his trial, and it was a really surreal moment. They had an inmate who testified that Chad bragged about the killing, and he said that he talked about the little girl. And one of just a heartbreaking, crushing moment, the guy gets on the stand and said that, you know, he wanted to enjoy her because she was going to die anyway. And I remember just looking at the jurors, they're crying. Of course, the family members are all in there, they're crying. I mean, I have a lump in my throat, and I've covered many murder cases. So anyway, Chad was convicted, and so was Billy later. His trial was in 2012. They were both given life without parole. And the reason they weren't given death sentences in the cases is because the case is circumstantial. Mary Green, Chad's mother, and Billy's former wife had to testify. She was the most crucial witness, and prosecutors were afraid that if the death penalty was on the table, especially with her son, that she might not be as forthcoming in her testimony. So they had to take that off the table, and so both these guys are in prison for the rest of their lives now. And I tell people, when you read this story, when you research this case, it is about – you've never watched a horror movie or read a horror novel any worse than what happened to that family. I mean, the crime scene photos are just brutal. I mean, it was literally – you hear the term bloodbath in this business a lot. It literally – that house was awash in blood. The autopsy photos of Lisa Elliott, I've seen – many, many autopsy photos, and hers were the absolute most heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to see that. I've never experienced crime scene photos, and if I can avoid it, I will.
Yeah.
What you talk about, what's really fascinating part of this book, and I wanted to ask you too, I don't know if you've come to this conclusion, but it seems very irresponsible, it would seem, even on the limited amount of evidence that they had, because you uncovered a lot of stuff, and it came out later when Chad was put in that position against his father to try to mount some kind of defense. So you talk about the evidence that was there, that there was two killers, and there was evidence from Mary about the phone call and from Chad's ex-girlfriend. So they put this thing together that there certainly was a call, that there certainly was a lot of evidence to say that they were both involved. So it seemed irresponsible to me in that first trial to be able to convict Billy completely and no culpability on Chad's part, it seemed. Talk more about the dilemma that Mary had, Billy's wife and Chad's mother in this, and what it seemed, in your respect, that it seemed what she was trying to do at trial for her son and against her husband.
Well, it was clearly obvious to me. And here's the thing about, you know, being a journalist, and I know that you can appreciate this. Many people don't ever step foot in a courtroom. Like people who sit on juries, the only time they're ever in a courtroom is the day they're on a jury. A lot of the people who testify in these capital murder cases, they don't have the totality of what happened in the courtroom because they can't be in there when other people are testifying. And so as a reporter, you get to sit there and you get to listen to every single person testify. You talk to the jurors afterwards. You talk to the family members during. So you have an insight that really no one else can get. And it was pretty obvious to me after covering both capital murder cases and seeing Mary testify. She was really trying to minimize Chad's involvement. She got chastised a couple times because she would say, well, if Chad did it, it was because Billy told him to. It was kind of one of those deals. And they even asked her, and obviously, when you gave the intro, one of the stories about the little girl is that she was tied up and kept in a garage in a barrel. And they asked Mary, they said, did you ever ask Chad about where the girl was kept and what happened to her? And she just cried and said, no, I never asked. And they said, why? And she said, because I didn't want to know. So she tried, but she was obviously very traumatized during Billy's trial. I mean, she would walk in the courtroom as soon as she saw him. I mean, you could see it in her face. I mean, the man had traumatized her a lot. So she, but she was a pretty, she was credible. I thought she, and as any mother would do, she tried to protect her son to some degree, but at the end of the day, she still gave the critical facts that they needed. There was a phone call the night of the murders, Billy left. He said he had to go help Chad clean up a mess. And so, and I always took that, like the prosecutors always took that comment from that night to mean that he was going to help Chad kill the family. And again, Billy being a sophisticated criminal, I don't know why, if they were to kill him that night, I don't know why it wouldn't have been better planned out, I guess is the best way to put it. And why would they kill the whole family when they could just kill Carl and they would probably, there would be less. When you kill a family of four like that, I mean, that makes national news, But if you just kill another guy involved in the drug trade with you, there's a good chance they won't even solve that crime. I mean, that's just a hard fact, but it's true. And so it was clumsy, in my opinion. Carl had some superficial wounds to his neck, like somebody maybe scraped him with a knife. They weren't thrust. From a knife and killing the people with a tire tool in the house. I mean, that's just kind of one of those things where you just grab whatever's handy to try to hit somebody with it. So, I just think that, that Billy, I've said this before, I don't think it had anything to do with Carl or Lisa or Gregory's death. I think it's possible he might've killed Felicia though, that maybe he found out that Chad had, there was one story that was, that several people testified to in court that Chad had fallen in love with Felicia after keeping her for a couple of days and he couldn't kill her and that his dad had to do it because he knew as soon as he found out that Chad had kept her, he knew that she would lead the police directly to them. So he took her out to the creek and slit her throat and she drowned in this wet weather creek. So I think that's possible. I talked to Billy right after the convictions. I mean, as soon as the gavel went down, the judge called a recess. I went up to him, his defense attorneys. They would freely let him talk to me. So, and he looked sincere when he said, I didn't do this, but, like I said, there's hard to feel sorry for a guy, his rap sheet is very, very long. He's committed many, many other brutal crimes. So like I said, he would be in jail for the rest of his life anyway, on all the drug charges he had been convicted of previous to all of this.
And these drug charges too, why they really, he was important is because you say it was much harder to convict him with the circumstantial evidence of murder, but to tie him in with a drug dealing and homicide connected was much easier and attainable. But this guy is an important person that they think has killed before in the commission of his drug business.
Yes, and very possible. Lots of rumors. He was never convicted of any of these, but there were lots of rumors. He lived in southern Missouri for several years. A lot of nefarious connections up in that area. He was actually shot and all but died himself at a barroom brawl one night. But yeah, he's a rough guy. I've been asked this question several times, like who's the worst person you've ever been around? And I would tell him without a doubt, it's Chad Green, and right behind him is his dad, Billy.
What do you think, because you provide that in this book, conclusions to all these cases, you're right there. What was your conclusion on how this went down and why?
What I believe is that Chad was out that night, and he was out driving around. His truck broke down by the river, and it was about a mile from Carl's house. I think he walked up to the house, asked Carl to help him. I think they went down to the river. They probably consumed drugs together. Chad had a really bad habit. When he got high at parties and stuff, he would take out his .22 and shoot at people because he thought it was funny. And I think what happened in this case is they either got into an argument or Chad was just doing the stupid thing that he always did when he got high. He pulled the gun out, and I think he accidentally shot Carl. And when he did, he freaked out. He shot him again. He got his pocket knife out, and he was going to slit his throat, and then he thought, no, I'm not going to do that. He's dead anyway. So he threw him in the river, and he knew that Lisa had just made him a glass of tea before he left the house with Carl. So he went back up to the house, and he knew that all the family members knew that he had left with Carl, and if they found Carl's body in the river, Chad would be the primary suspect. He knew that he would go to prison, so he went up there and slaughtered that family to protect himself. He was a pedophile, the little girl. There's actually been some rumors that he had already started to molest her before the murders. And so I think he took her, and that's what I think happened. But then I think Billy tried to help him cover it up after the fact.
So you don't believe it was on orders to kill this family or collect this debt from Carl?
No, I believe that Billy had threatened Chad because Carl was his friend. A few weeks prior to the murders, Mary was in her flower garden or flower beds, and she overheard a conversation between Billy and Chad, basically where Billy was telling Chad, "You better get my stuff from Carl, or you and him are going to get it." Which, you know, and there was a theory floated for years that it was over 10 pot plants. Well, again, Billy's a sophisticated criminal. He might go and beat Carl up over some pot plants, but I really don't think he would kill him over it because just for the simple fact that, yeah, again, that's going to lead the police right to you and it's going to shut your drug operation down. So, again, is it possible? Yes. I mean, we'll probably never really know what happened. But I think just from the circumstances, the clumsiness of it, that's the main thing. I mean, they left the tire tool at the house. There is no way Billy Green is leaving that tire tool at that house. So, and just the fact that it was ill prepared. I mean, like I said before, if you want to deal with Carl and him not paying a debt or stealing drugs from you, you're not going to kill his whole family. I mean, even if it comes to the point where you decide you're going to kill him, you're going to find some other way to do it.
Incredible, horrible case. Let's go to the case of Sydney Nicole Randall, another heartbreaking case. You talk about this. She's a fifth grader in Walnut Ridge, a rural southern town in northern Arkansas, in Lawrence County. Tell us, again, set the stage for this, and you talk about her mother, Denise Cornell. She's a cancer survivor, and Sydney has a stepfather, John Cornell, big guy, 250 pounds, mid-30s. Tell us a little bit about their family situation there in Walnut Ridge. What's going on March 2013?
Well, actually, Sydney, she was in the fifth grade when my wife first encountered her. My wife's a fifth grade science teacher. And
right.
Sydney was one of her students in the first class that she ever taught. Lawrence County is a farming community, or not Lawrence County, excuse me, Walnut Ridge is a farming community in Lawrence County. It sits on the near the Black River, which kind of bifurcates the Ozark Mountain region and the Mississippi Delta region. So when you come into Walnut Ridge, you're coming into the first, bigger Delta town. coming out of the Ozark foothills. Lots of soybeans, peanuts, corn, just an agricultural area. And what happened was Sydney was in the eighth grade. She was a beauty pageant queen. She was on the flag line team for the band. I knew her. She, my daughter played softball. She would come to, she was friends with several girls that my daughter played softball with, and so she'd come and watch them play. I would go in my wife's classroom occasionally, and I would see Sydney in there. You know, she was a pretty and respectful girl. Everybody loved her. I mean, she was a great kid. And so what happened is on March 10th, 2013, her and her stepfather vanished. And what happened was Denise was fell asleep that night. She had had, I believe she had back surgery, and she had taken a Xanax or something like that that had kind of knocked her out. And so when she woke up, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, she noticed John wasn't in bed with her. And she went around the house checking on her three kids, and she noticed that Sydney was missing. And so she started calling around, and none of her friends knew where she was at. You know, at first she thought maybe she just snuck out. You know, she's an eighth grader. I mean, kids do stuff like that. And maybe John went out to look for her. You know, that was kind of what she was thinking. Well, none of her friends had any idea, so she calls the hospital to see if maybe there was some accident or something happened. And then she calls the police because John's wallet and his cell phone, all that was still at the house. So right around the time she's waiting outside, this is like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and there's always been a little confusion about this, about the date, just for, or the time, just because of the simple fact that time changed that night. So it was just kind of a weird thing. So she's waiting. Well, John's truck pulls into the driveway, and she said, "Is Sydney with you?" And he said, "No." And she said, "Well, she's missing." And he said, that's BS. And he said, he's going to the police to file a report. So he leaves. Well, the police officer arrives a few minutes later, and Denise is like, did my husband come and file a police report? The police officer says no. And so so all the next day, she's out looking for her. I had heard something. I caught, like, the tail end of a missing girl in Walnut Ridge story when I was watching news. I didn't catch the name, but it's not uncommon for a stepfather to, you know, be molesting his stepchild, and then, you know, they take off together and they're found in some other state. I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's not an uncommon tale. So my wife calls me. That was on a Sunday. On Monday morning, my wife called me at my office, and she's panicked. She said, Sydney's missing. And I was like, well, they'll find her. You know, don't worry about it, you know. But then at 3 o'clock that afternoon, they found John's body on a gravel road just outside of Walnut Ridge, and he had shot himself. And so at that point, we knew it was bad. And it's a really weird thing, like, I've been a journalist for a long time. It's a really weird thing writing about someone you knew. And it was heartbreaking. I had a lot of, like, inside access to the family just because they knew my wife. She was their kid's teacher. I knew them. My kids knew them. I mean, everybody knew her. So I was able to get, like, a lot of times when the family wouldn't talk to anybody, they'd still talk to me. And so I was able to write stories about it. But, you know, the days and weeks went on. They never found – hadn't found her. And, of course, as springtime comes along, you know, foliage starts to grow. The landscape starts to change. And so there was kind of an assumption that if they didn't find her, you know, before spring started, that they may never find her. But that all changed on May 18th, 2013. A guy was out fishing with his family. They were checking some drop lines on the Black River, and they looked over, and there's trees that grow up through the riverbed, and they looked over and they noticed what looked like a mannequin at first. And they went over there. Of course, the father immediately knew that it was a body as soon as he got a little closer. So then he got the rest of the younger kids and the rest of the family members downriver, and then him and his oldest son went back They called the police. I was actually at the park playing basketball with my kids when the word came. It's amazing how I remember when I first started as a reporter, you know, you'd go down to the police station, you know, you gotta try to find some way to get them to give you information. Nowadays with Facebook, you know, I think I knew within 7 or 8 minutes of the call going into the 911 center that they found her. And it was simply because people share that stuff on social media now, you know. And so anyway, they confirmed it was her a day or two later. And it was just a really – it's a heartbreaking case. It's it just hurts your soul to know that little girl – and I'll say this. I got her autopsy reports, and they found her DNA on his penis. So they know – that he raped and killed her before that she was raped before she was killed. And in the book, I talk about this. I think probably what happened was is he was having violent sex with her, and I think he hurt her, and then he didn't know what to do. He freaked out. He hit her over the head. She died from a blunt force trauma to the head, and she drowned. So he hit her in the head, and he threw her in the river, and she drowned. And a case like this, it's really tough because I actually had to deal with some of his family members. And, you know, they don't want to believe that he's this horrible rapist, murder monster. But the problem is that he was. He did these things. And, you know, in my reporting, I didn't say anything about where they found her DNA. I just said they found her DNA on him. And then I had to tell one of his family members that, you know, hey, they actually found it on his penis. There's no doubt that her DNA should not be there. And if he had gotten back into that house, and I've contemplated this, if he had gotten back in the house at night, let's just say Denise doesn't wake up. He slips back into bed, and then there's no proof at all that he had anything to do with her murder.
Yeah, that's a terrifying idea or thought.
Yeah.
And there was Ben, the younger son, or the son, he had also said, yeah, he had confirmed that John Cornell was abusing his daughter, stepdaughter.
Yes. What happened was is he started gifting Sydney several months before this. He bought her a laptop. He would buy her pageant dresses. I mean, he took her pageant dress shopping. And, you know, right there, that's bizarre behavior. Anybody can see that. And he wouldn't let her have a boyfriend. He would take her cell phone away from her all the time. He didn't want boys around her. And, Denise, you know, she, in the police report, she talks about, you know, their sex life changing pretty dramatically because of the surgery she had had. And she began to suspect that, you know, that he might be molesting her. You know, they lived in a pretty small house. It wasn't like, I mean, I imagine they all knew what was going on.
That's incredible. Let's use this as an opportunity, George, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor today, Warby Parker. Warby Parker started as a collaboration between four close friends. Warby Parker was conceived as an alternative to the overpriced and bland eyewear available today. Warby Parker is vintage-inspired with a contemporary twist. Every pair is a custom fit with anti-reflective polycarbonate prescription lenses. They have a free home try-on program. Order 5 pairs of glasses and try them on for 5 days. There's no obligation to buy. They ship free and include a prepaid return shipping label. Head to warbyparker.com/truemurder to order your free home try-ons today. Glasses start at $95. Including prescription lenses. And lenses include anti-glare and anti-scratch coatings. For every pair you buy, also, a pair is distributed to someone in need. The glasses look fantastic, by the way, and the try-on program is really, really easy. And I like getting other people's opinions about the glasses before I even purchase them. Do you have an iPhone X? Make sure to download Warby Parker's app, where you can use their brand new feature, Find Your Fit. Find Your Fit uses the iPhone X's True Depth camera to map and measure key facial features. Using these measurements, Find Your Fit recommends approximately 12 Warby Parker frames that are likely to best fit for your face. The process is seamless and takes only a few seconds. After that, you head to warbyparker.com/truemurder and place your home try-on orders. Make sure to download the Warby Parker app from iTunes App Store. They built this great app, which allows you to take photos wearing all of the frames. You can stitch it into a video, and then you can share it with your friends and your family and basically pick the winner, the ones that you really like. So go to parker.com/truemurder and order your home try-on today. That's warbyparker.com/truemurder. Now, George, in your Chapter 3, you talk about another missing persons case. You start off with this, that you're shopping, and you notice a missing persons poster, a young mother named Bridget Sellers, and it made an impression. Now, you talk about a year later, you're working your first serious newspaper reporting job at an area-wide media in Salem, Arkansas. Tell us about how this very impressive missing poster has made a very big impression on you. What happened with Bridget Sellers and this story?
Well, I just graduated from college, and I went on a trip to Europe. I'd been gone for about a month, and the first night I came back, I was just at a local store shopping, walked through the doors. It was, like a really nice warm spring night. I look over on the wall and I see this picture of this woman, and it left an impression on me because she kind of looked like my wife in the picture. So I just kind of noticed it. For whatever reason, and who knows why, it just never left me. I wasn't working at a newspaper at that time. About a year and a half later, I started working at a newspaper. And, as a reporter, you keep lists of stories that you want to work on. You know, when there's no breaking news or not covering a meeting or whatnot, you just have a list of things you want to work on. One day I was working on my list, and I thought, I wonder if they ever did any stories about this missing woman. So I go into my editor's office, a guy named David Cox, who is one of the best editors I've ever had. I walked in. I said, David, did you guys ever do any stories about a missing mother? And he had no idea what I was talking about. So I started doing some digging around, and I found out that this mother of three had gone for a walk on a road called Peace Valley Road, ironically enough. And it connects two towns. Horseshoe Bend is a retirement community in Ash Flat. It's just a rural thoroughfare. You know, people, it's not heavily traveled. There's, sporadic houses and farms along this place. There's a cemetery and church, all this kind of thing. Well, I got the name of the aunt who put the posters up, but there had been a phone number that was associated with her, and I called the number. It was disconnected. I think I got an address, maybe. I tried to go. I'm literally the kind of reporter, I will go to someone's house. I've done it before. So I went to the house. They didn't live there no more. Nobody knew where they were at. So I kind of just gave up on it. Well, my sister was at the same store a couple years later buying a sprinkler for my kids to play with. And she brought it home. The sprinkler just totally sucked. So we decided we were going to go to Horseshoe Bend. There's a lake there. And we thought we'd just go swimming at the lake. Well, we're driving down Peace Valley Road. And my sister's telling me a story about how she met a woman in line at the store, and the woman was a dog breeder, and she had a St. Bernard puppy that my sister's friend might be interested in. So the woman gave her a card. Well, of course, it was the aunt. And so I immediately called her right there on the road. I called the aunt, and I'm like, hey, I want to do a story about your missing niece. And she said, great. She goes, she was mad the police weren't looking for her, nobody was doing anything to try to find this girl. So I go and I do the story. She actually lived on Peace Valley Road. And the dynamic is that she lived on Peace Valley Road, and so did an uncle on Bridget's dad's side. He also lived on Peace Valley Road. And I asked her if she had any idea who might have done this, who could have taken her. She didn't give me any names, but it was pretty obvious to me that she was pretty scared of the other uncle on Bridget's dad's side. So right. The police finally, there was a jurisdiction issue. There's two counties that meet right there, Sharp and Izzard counties. And so the police had some, there was jurisdiction issues. They didn't know if it was their case because she was walking on the road, you know, who, which agency should take care of this. So finally they search his property and they don't find anything, but he was pretty clearly the suspect. And just to back up a little bit, when I went to the aunt's house, I mean, it was unbelievably filthy. I've literally gone on drug raids where I saw an officer lose half his hand one time. I felt safer there than I was at this house. I mean, there were pit bulls everywhere, Rottweilers. They were breeding, I think, timber wolves. It was really, it was a crazy scene. And of course, Bridget's son was living with him. He was a little guy. He was about 2 or 3. And I took a picture of him on a swing set. And so anyway, the police search the property. They don't find anything. Well, a few months go by. I actually took a different newspaper job. Well, then I get a tip that they're going to go check this guy's house again. And this time they're going to clean out his sewer tank. And they do that, and they find some of her, she had kind of a bone deformity that affected her fingers, and they found some finger bones in there, and they were tested for, and they had this bone deformity that she had, so they knew that her body had been in there. What was really bizarre is that none of her bigger bones were found, and like her skull or her torso, and what they think happened is he actually, after the first search, the Jerry Stevens, they think that he went back into that septic tank and actually fished her big bones out. Nobody knows what he did with them. So, and the day after they find these bones, that they were going to charge him with capital murder, he actually ended up dying from cancer. So he never got convicted in that case.
And you looked into his background. You talk about previous violence, we'll say. Tell us a little bit about that, what you found in terms of his past violent record.
He had shot and killed, I believe, his own father back in the 70s. I think they ended up ruling it a justified homicide. And then he had also been charged and convicted of some sexual misconduct with Bridget when she was a child. And when Bridget went for a walk that day on the road, she got into a fight with her aunt because her aunt wanted her, you know, she had been doing some dabbling in some minor drug stuff. She had been an irresponsible mother. I mean, I think you could probably safely say that. And so at least two of the kids were living with that aunt at the time, and she got mad, and that's why she went for a walk. And when her killer came upon her, I don't know if he killed her because of the minor sexual misconduct charge that he had leveled against him years before, or there's other, you know, other rumors that he may have been involved in some drug stuff and she was involved with him. But for whatever reason, he came upon her that day and he killed her. I mean, he chopped her up and he stuffed her in a septic tank.
You talk about the incredible search, and I found this very interesting, too. They had everything from cadaver dogs, and they had so they had gone by that septic tank. Like you say, you theorize, or other people theorize, that he went and took, like, the skull out or the torso. Obviously, they would have been there if they would have searched. So they speculate that he took them out. But these cadaver dogs, tell us why they couldn't detect anything, even though they had this incredible search for Bridget.
I've wondered about that. The police officers that I talked to about this, because they had several cadaver dogs out on the property, and they never hit on the septic tank. I think that just the overwhelming mix of smells in the septic tank probably confused the dogs, or if they hit on the septic tank, they may not have, it might be common for dogs to hit on septic tanks just because of the smell. So I never could get a clear answer on that. I will say this, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I read a lot about different murder cases. I've never heard of anybody stuffing a body in a septic tank like that. So, you know, maybe that's just a place you can hide, you know, one, and it just makes it that much harder for the dogs to hit.
I think so, yeah. And you say that maybe Becky Jones, what was the speculation that she may have known that Jerry Stevens killed Bridget?
Yeah, I think she probably at least suspected it. She didn't tell me that. But when his name was brought up, you know, she really didn't want to talk about him. So she obviously knew he was a dangerous guy. She also knew there was a connection between him and Bridget. I could tell there was definitely something there. I don't think she wanted to speculate, but, you know, if your niece goes missing, you know, there's a guy who possibly has a motive that lives literally as the crow flies, you know, just a few hundred yards from you. Like I said, it's a rural area. If she went for a walk, you know, the chances of him coming upon her, pretty good. So I think she probably had some suspicion, but, you know, if she suspected he killed her, she was definitely keeping that to herself, with me anyway.
Wow. You take us to another story where a farm service store where they would sell products related to farms in Walnut Ridge, Arkansas, again. And this attendant named Moore, he's working there for about 17 years, and he sees this Bob Castleman, 60-year-old guy. This is April 2011, and he's got this canister of Coleman camp fuel. Tell us a little bit about Moore and the cooperation with police and why this canister of Coleman camp fuel is cause for suspicion. Tell us this story that you start off with.
Well, the reason that it's suspicious is in Arkansas and a lot of southern states, poorer states, there's been just an epidemic of methamphetamine use. There's a lot of people who make methamphetamine. It's cheap to make. It's highly addictive. And this Bob Castleman guy, he had gone into the farm service store there in Walnut Ridge, and he was buying some components, some tubing, campfire fuel. There's just certain earmarks for making methamphetamine, and those products, you know, and you kind of, when you see people who are addicted to meth, you immediately know who they are. I walk into a courtroom, you know, on a court day, and you know, you can see out in the crowd, you can look, you know who's addicted to meth and who's not. I mean, it's obvious. And so he saw Bob Castleman. He saw him try to buy some components. He knew that he was trying to buy these to make meth. And so he calls the police, and sure enough, they find a bunch of this stuff. Well, Bob, it's an interesting story. He was an attorney. He had spent some time as a judge. He had graduated, you know, from law school. He was a Vietnam vet. In fact, his brother was one of the prosecutors on the Billy and Chad Green murder trials. So he came from a family of lawyers, and he just devolved into this criminal. And it all started. I'm sure someone knows, but he had a pretty highly successful law practice there in a town called Pocahontas, which is the county seat in Randolph County. And, you know, he made a lot of money. He was connected to a lot of people and very well liked, by the way. A lot of people liked Bob Castleman. And he had a son, and the son had gotten into a dispute with one of their neighbors. And the dispute escalated to the point where the son actually went over to the neighbor's house and had destroyed part of their yard. Like, he drove his SUV into their yard, and he did donuts or whatever you would do, destroyed the yard. Well, when he was coming back home later that night, as he was passing by the neighbor's house, the neighbor was outside with a gun and actually shot into his SUV a number of times and almost killed him. You know, one bullet landed just literally inches from his head. And so Bob, you know, obviously wanted the neighbor to be charged with, you know, aggravated assault, you know, and go to prison. Well, the police finally, after about a year, told him, they said, hey, and this was back in 2001, told him that he's only going to get charged with like a misdemeanor assault charge because they credibly thought that the guy was fearing for his life when the sun was coming back down there. And so Bob decides to mail a live copperhead to this family. And the woman, they drop it in the post office there in town, this cylindrical tube with this live copperhead in it. Well, they check their mail one day, and this tube is in there. They open the woman opens the tube. They're sitting in a truck. Her husband's driving. She's sitting in the middle, and they've got a friend who's sitting on the other side of her. And in the back seat, they've got another person and two kids. I think one of them was in a car seat. And she opens the tube, and the snake pops out right at her face. She said that the snake got within a couple inches of her head. Well, she throws the box, the whole thing, onto the guy that's sitting next to her, then he tosses it out the window. The box landed in a way that it trapped the snake. And so the police were able to come, and they shot the snake. It didn't take them very long to figure out who sent it and why. And so he's charged. Of course, here's the thing. When you mail something like that, it becomes a federal crime. And, of course, the story made international news. I mean, it's just so bizarre, you know, somebody mailing a live snake to a neighbor. And so he got charged in federal court. He lost his law license. He went to prison for several years. So did his son. And when he got back out, he had to find something to do. And he got mixed up into drugs, making meth. His family owned a large farm out in a rural part of Randolph County. And so they would go there and they would make their meth, you know? And, so he got busted a couple times for, some other drug stuff. And then finally, this whole incident that we were talking about, the farm service store went down. Not too long after that, they busted a major drug ring. And it was like 8 or 9 people involved. One of them was the police chief and Pogonos' wife. There were some other pretty prominent people. Yeah, it was a big time. It was a big deal. And it was a federal drug probe. Well, and you know this, Dan, it's when you get 8 or 9 people in a conspiracy, the first thing you do is you try to get some of the, you get the littler fish to try to go after the big fish. So you give them plea deals sure. and they testify. And it was pretty obvious that, the U.S. attorneys working this case, they were going to go after Bob. He was the one they wanted and his son. So, they start cutting deals with all these people, it got to a point where they were getting closer and closer to Bob. There was a guy named Travis Perkins who, he was the main guy as far as, making meth. He was friends with the son. He knew the ins and outs of the operation, and he was the one person who could tie this all together for police. Well, or for prosecutors, excuse me. Well, 3 days before he was going to testify in federal court, he's found dead in his apartment. And obviously, of course, as you can imagine, the primary suspect was Bob and his son, primary suspects. Well, eventually, they don't have any evidence of he was shot a single time. And here's the thing. To this day, I don't think the FBI investigated. They haven't released any information about the murder. The only reason I knew anything about the murder was I actually talked to the guy who found Travis. And so, eventually, it got to a culminating point where prosecutors were basically they were going to go after Jared really hard, and Bob was always really worried about his son being in prison, obviously. So finally, they cut the deal where Jared's actually going to testify against his dad. And see, here's the thing. Bob had never charged with Travis's murder, but the drug, if you can prove that a homicide was connected to a federal drug case, the enhancements would basically put him in jail for the rest of his life. So through kind of a quirk in the law, they got Jared on the stand, and he testified that his father killed Travis to keep him quiet. And so because they were able to successfully prove that a homicide was attached to this drug ring, then everything was in hand. So he's going to be in jail for 45 or 50 years now, you know, and he's already 60. So, I mean, he's essentially got a life sentence. So, and then Jared got a much lesser sentence, the son, you know, for his involvement in all this. So, it's just a really, I always say this, and by the way, going back just a little bit, before he actually got arrested in the drug probe, he loved to collect Native American artifacts, and obviously there's a deep and rich Native American history up in that part of Arkansas. The town is named Pocahontas. I mean, so you know, there's a lot of Native Americans that lived there for 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 years ago. I mean, it's they used to hunt and fish along the Black River there, and so he collected all this stuff. Well, he needed money for his defense, you know, expenses. So he had insurance on this elaborate Native American Indian collection, and he claimed that it got stolen. Well, the FBI went to a friend's house about 25 miles away and found all the stuff in the living room. So he got charged with that, you know, mail fraud basically, because he had, you know, sent the communication to the insurance company, falsifying that he had lost, this stuff had been stolen. So I tell people all this time, his story is one of the most interesting criminal cases that you will find, just because of the family history, his position in life, and how it just all just went off the rails for him.
Absolutely. Now you talk about, and we talk about in the opening, about the update on the unsolved Rebecca Gould case. Tell us a little bit more about the Rebecca Gould case.
Rebecca Gould is a very deeply personal case to me. It's the first murder case I ever covered. I was actually out there the day they found her body. Again, very rare to even as a journalist to actually be out with a search party and, you know, actually find the body when they're out looking for it. And so basically what happened is I would call the sheriff's departments, you know, every week, the police, you know, the routine. You call them up, try to see what's going on. Well, this girl, this 22-year-old college student, she vanished from a friend's house on September 20th, 2004 in Melbourne, Arkansas. And it was kind of a weird case. She had dropped her friend off at work. She was supposed to go pick up a sister and head back to Northwest Arkansas, where she was a college student. And she was in Melbourne just visiting friends over the weekend. And so she goes back to the friend's house to collect her stuff, and I think to probably take a nap, just by the just because she put like a breakfast sandwich in a microwave, and literally was still sitting in there when the police finally went through the house. Well, something happened to her. She vanished. Her car keys were there. Her purse was there. Everything was left, but she was gone. And I catch wind of this, of her disappearance. And I got to, during that week, I kind of got to know her family a little bit. Her dad is a real prominent dentist and a nice guy. And then she's got a bunch of sisters. And, you know, they were all, seemed like real nice ladies. And they were out looking for her. And so a week later, fast forward to a week later, I'm in Melbourne at the courthouse. I hear some ladies talking about searchers out in a particular area off the road. I ask them where it's at. They tell me. I go out there, and they found her. And I saw her. I'll never forget it. Just, again, gut-wrenching. And so I go back to the sheriff's office. Well, a rumor started to circulate that they found the body. And her dad came up to me and said, "Hey, did they find my daughter?" And I said, "Larry," his name is Larry Gould. I said, "Larry, you really need to talk to the sheriff." And he kind of grabbed hold of me, and he said it again. And I was like, yes, they did. And in my first book that I wrote, Witches in West Memphis, I was a little reticent to describe her body because I didn't even tell her family that I was writing a chapter about this. And so I kind of just, I didn't describe it. I just couldn't, because I didn't know if they knew or if they'd want people knowing those kind of details, because it was personal.
Sure.
You know, I met them. So in the second book, The Creekside Bones, you know, I actually, this is kind of an interesting side story. So her case has never been solved. It's basically a cold case now. She was hit in the head, possibly with a piano leg, of all things. And so that was the last time I saw her dad was during this whole that day that her body was found. So I'm doing a book signing at a library in April 2016. And my first book was about the West Memphis 3 case. I've written like 100 stories about that case and news stories. And so, but I included a chapter about Rebecca because all it takes is for one person to crack this case wide open, as in many cases. You know, like when Mary Green walked in the police station and told the truth that day, that broke that case open. So I always think, okay, if we just get enough stories out there, if we generate enough buzz about it, eventually somebody's going to crack, and this case will get solved. So at every book signing, when I would pitch the book to anybody, I would always, at the end, go back to that, to this story. And so I'm at this book signing, and I asked this guy, I said, so do you want to buy a book? And he says, no. He says, I want to buy 10 of them. And I'm like, okay. So I grabbed 10 books, and there was a photographer there from a magazine doing a spread on my book, and I told the photographer, I whispered to her, I said, whatever I told him, I need to tell everybody, you know. And so this guy, I flip over the first book, and I go, who do I need to sign this to? And he reaches in his pocket, and he pulls out a ribbon with a face on it, and it's Rebecca's face, and he sets it on the book. And as soon as he did it, I knew who he was. When I had seen Larry, you know, years before, he was obviously unkempt, wearing a hat, not shaving. You know, he just looked disheveled, for obvious reasons, couldn't find his daughter. And so he, of course, I got up, I gave him a hug, we both started crying, you know how that goes. And so to this day, that was about a year and a half ago, I see him. I go and see him periodically. I've written stories about it and giving them away for free to newspapers and other publications just so they will the memory of what happened to her doesn't die, and hopefully somebody will come forward with some credible information that can solve the case.
Absolutely. Now, you talk about that this, because it is a little misleading, that the Witches of West Memphis is just about the West Memphis Three, meaning Damien Echols, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly, convicted in 1993. But you include those other stories. So tell us a little bit about just the stories that aren't involved with Damien Echols and Jason Baldwin and Miskelly that you've included in Witches in West Memphis.
In that book, I included the prologue is about Rebecca Gould, what we just talked about. And then I included another murder case in there involving an 11-year-old named Jessica Williams. And the reason I included that in that book, and I'm sure a lot of people who, a lot of your listeners are familiar with the West Memphis 3 case,
yes.
You know, that case boiled down to a false confession by Jesse Miskelly Jr. If you believe the confession, then you think they're guilty. If you don't believe the confession, then you think they're innocent. And so in that, it's a real interesting case. So Jessica Williams, it was almost, the West Memphis 3 were released from prison on August 19th, 2011. Well, almost 2 years to the day, this little 11-year-old girl, Jessica Williams, was playing in her yard in a little town called Gosnell. It's not far from the Mississippi River. And her dad, she was out with her bike, and she had a puppy named Rybok that she kept in a, you know, like she had a little basket on the front of the bike. So she put the puppy in there, and she's riding around, you know, just like little girls do. And her dad looks out a second time, and she's gone. And they live out in a rural area. They live down a gravel road. And so he goes out to look for her, and within a few minutes he finds her bike on the side of the road. And then he calls the police. They spend all night searching. Gosnell's actually maybe an hour's drive from West Memphis, and it's actually in the same judicial district as West Memphis, meaning the prosecutor in the West Memphis 3 case is also that's his territory as well. He prosecutes cases in that area too. So the next morning, a couple girls on ATVs, they find the dog walking about 11 miles down a gravel road, 11 miles from her house. So searchers take the dog back to the spot where the dog was found. And of course the dog leads them right to her body. She was found in a drainage ditch just off of a bridge. And so within 24 hours, her 17-year-old mentally indigent neighbor who rode the school bus with her, a guy named Christopher Sal, he confesses to her murder. And he even gets a couple of details right. Well, so they give him a $2 million bond. They throw away the key. You know, they throw him in jail, throw away the key. And everybody, the judge puts a gag order, so there's no information coming out. Of course, I know the prosecutor really well over there. And so I talked to him, and I kept asking him the same question. One thing that just bothered me about it was he didn't have a car, and he was out helping her dad look for her within 30 minutes of her disappearance, this Christopher Sal. And so in my mind, I was sitting there going, how did he get her out there, and then how did he get back in time to help her dad look for her? And they said, well, there's a gag order, we can't talk about it, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, they found one sperm cell on her body during her autopsy, and they only found one. And they DNA tested it, and it didn't belong to Christopher Sal. It belonged to another neighbor who had come home early from work that day who had little kids that played with her. So he got charged with raping the girl. And then eventually after 7-8 months, I can't remember exactly how much time he spent in jail, but they finally had to release him, and then they finally had to say that he had falsely confessed to the girl's murder. And I included it because a lot of people don't think that false confessions happen, and I will get that all the time. People say, I just don't believe in false confessions. I will go and speak to high school groups. I will go and speak to college groups. And one of the questions I will ask them, would you ever confess to a murder you didn't commit? And, Dan, I'm telling you right now, every single time I do it, a couple of kids will raise their hands. And I'll ask them to come up, and I'll say, why would you do it? And a lot of times they'll say, well, if the police are asking this question, they must think I know something, so I'm trying to help them. Or they say they would do it to try to help a loved one or a friend. And it's a very consistent pattern. They all say very similar things, and they all say, every group I've ever talked to, at least one or two hands is shot, and sometimes more than that.
That is incredible. Why we mentioned your book, The Witches of West Memphis, is because you're back on True Murder in the new year, starting off the new year, January 3rd. So we're going to be talking about that. What I found interesting, very interesting, is that you say you've done about 100 articles, and nobody has written more articles about the West Memphis 3 case. Is that true?
Yeah, that's what I've been told that. You know, there's been several documentaries made about the case. Amy Berg did a documentary called West of Memphis. When she first started that project, she contacted me, and I asked her why she contacted me, and she said from the research she had done, I had written more stories about it than anyone else. So then I called Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sinofsky, you know, the two guys who did the Paradise Lost franchise, the three documentaries about the case. And Bruce told me, he said for sure, because when they would come to town, especially when they were filming Paradise Lost 3 Purgatory, you know, I would hang out with them. I would do interviews with them, and we would go around. And so I knew them really well. They're good guys. Of course, Bruce obviously passed away a few years ago, but actually ran into Joe. He was in Little Rock in April. The state of Arkansas in April was going to execute 8 inmates because the chemicals they used the lethal injection chemicals they used were about to run out of date. So they catched a kind of a crazy plan to try to, kill 8 death row guys. And they ended up killing 4, and I was there for 3 of the 4 executions. But anyway, Joe was in Little Rock. Damien Echols came back to Arkansas to try to protest against the executions, and then Johnny Depp was with him, and it was kind of a weird scene. I was standing there at the Capitol steps, this big protest rally going on. There's media from all over the country because it was pretty widely covered. I look over beside the Capitol steps, and I see Johnny Depp and Damien Echols and Damien Echols' wife, Lori, standing there with a couple of bodyguards. And so I just walked over and started talking to them. Of course, I had interviewed Echols several times, including while he was on death row. So, from the research I've done, I don't even think it's close as far as how many stories. I worked at a newspaper in Jonesboro where all the Rule 37 hearings were held for, and those were just post-conviction hearings to try to get new trials. And they had, we're talking hundreds of hours of them being in court trying to get new trials. And I thought it was interesting, in your intro you were talking about Ted Bundy. The forensic odontologist who ID'd Ted Bundy actually testified in the West Memphis 3 case, and I interviewed him, a guy named Dr. Richard Suverin. And obviously we'll go into that, all that and all the other forensic experts who testified in the case. And so basically it was just by happenstance that I've actually written more stories about that case than anybody, just because I simply happened to be – my office was, just a few blocks away from the courtroom. So I was there every day for – over a several-year period, they would have a whole week every day, 9 to 5 testimony. And so I was there, the Associated Press. I would do stories for them and for our local newspapers. So,
yeah, it's a very controversial case, obviously. And on True Murder, we've handled 3 different authors with different viewpoints. So we're going to be looking forward to hearing your take on this, which is in West Memphis. I want to thank you very much, George, for coming on and talking about the Creekside Bones. Do you have a Facebook page, website, where people might look for other work, or a Facebook page for this book?
I have an author's Facebook page. It's Author George Jared, and you can go there. Just send me a friend request. I talk to people there all the time. I came to a stunning conclusion about a year and a half ago that pretty much everybody lives on social media now. And so Facebook, Instagram, stuff like that is just about as effective as having a website nowadays. So, they can friend me there. They can get my books on Amazon or at Barnes & Noble, wherever they want to get them. And I am more than happy. Some of these cases are controversial, especially West Memphis 3. I have debated many times with people who are on different sides of the issue, and I have no problem doing that. There's no way to definitively know what happened to those 3 kids, but there's a lot of evidence that points in certain directions.
It is certainly a case that captivated the imagination of audiences and still does to this day, and the responses from those programs have been very heated and very divergent in their opinions. So really looking forward to that. January 3rd, ushering in the new year on True Murder. Thank you very much, George Jared, for talking about the Creekside Bones. Reality is more horrifying than fiction. Thank you very much, George Jared. You have a great evening.
Dan, you too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good night.